Okay, let's get started. Today is March 13th, and this is Biology 160, and we're talking about the nervous system. And who's got some questions? We talked about some maybe freaky stuff last time, and things that you just kind of have to memorize to make sense out of. All right, like for instance, we talked about every cell is really what? Every cell in your body acts like a battery. Yeah, every cell in your body acts like a battery. It produces a voltage from the inside of the membrane to the outside of the membrane. And that voltage is due to a couple ions, a difference in concentration of ions. So you got to make sure you know this. So here we have a cell. And what were the two ions that we're concerned about? Sodium is one, and potassium is the other. So let's think of sodium. Where is sodium high, on the outside or inside? Sodium is high on the outside. So let's just draw this like that. And that's a cation, don't forget. Okay, what about that potassium? It's high concentration on the inside. All right, and there's a little membrane protein right here that's constantly forcing sodium out of the cell and forcing potassium inside the cell that requires ATP. I don't know if we went over that, but that's how that gradient develops, because there's actually ATP that are separating these ions out like this. That's active transport. All right, so it's high outside and high potassium on the inside. So that if we open up a little spot right here through the membrane for this potassium to go, is it going to want to move one way or the other? Yeah. It sure will. It will want to go from high to low just by diffusion, right? And with same thing for his sodium. It's going to want to go inside the cell just by diffusion. All right, so let me cover this up. All right, now let's remember that a nervous tissue is specialized to do what kind of thing? A neuron in particular. What's it specialized for? To transmit electricity or electrical impulses. And there is one term that we use to describe that basic electrical impulse, and that is that action potential. So a nerve fiber or nervous tissue transmit action potentials along a cell. And furthermore, there are two events. There are two terms that we use to describe an action potential. What were those two terms? Depolarization is one. And then repolarization is the other. So we got these two events. And then the last thing that you got to know is, how does that relate to some molecules that are involved with this cell right here? One is relating to sodium and the other relates to potassium. So depolarization is what? Depolarization is this one right here. Sodium entering the cell. That's depolarization. And then repolarization is what? Is this potassium leaving? Okay? So that, didn't bring any handouts. But see me after class. All right, so that's some of the strange stuff that you have to know about a neuron. Sodium high on the outside, potassium high on the inside. It transmits electrical information via an action potential. All right, action potential. And an action potential has got two parts, depolarization and repolarization. Depolarization is sodium moving in, repolarization is potassium coming back out. Okay. So that's how information is transmitted. Now up on the slide here, I have the very first slide that I showed, which shows some of the different organizations of the nervous system. Namely what? Central versus peripheral. You should appreciate that. The central nervous system is made of what? Brain and spinal cord. The peripheral nervous system you could break down into sensory versus motor, or afferent versus efferent. Which way do signal go? Which way do signals go in the sensory division? Yeah, from the periphery into your central nervous system, and then motor is the opposite, from your central nervous system to your periphery. All right, and then don't forget, motor could be broken down into two, somatic, which is voluntary, like the skeletal muscles, and then autonomic, which means what? Things you don't have control over, for instance, like your heart rate, blood vessel diameter, even your respirations. And then the autonomic nervous system has got these two divisions, sympathetic and parasympathetic. All right, so try to remember these. And I think we even had some questions in the student study guide for the quiz on Thursday. This is a good chart to know that it's in your book to look at. Okay, so last time we were talking about reflexes. So I'm going to slide that off unless someone has a question. Does anybody have a question about these action potentials and the sodium and potassium and that kind of stuff? New? Okay. The transmitters? Neurotransmitters? Oh, you know, I think I have some slides. I'll talk about neurotransmitters. That's coming up. But if I forget to mention it, make sure you remind me, okay? Okay. I think that's still coming up. All right, so we were talking about reflexes. And what's one handy thing about a reflex? Yeah, it's a relatively short distance, and they're important mechanisms that happen very quickly because it's short distances and without your conscious thought. So if you start to hurt yourself by stepping on something hot or sharp, then your body is going to respond and remove itself from that stimulus before you even have a conscious awareness that you're being hurt. All right, so these are the parts of that reflex, and we call it a reflex arc, if you can read backwards. Okay, I kind of tilted just a little bit. But a reflex always starts with a stimulus, like when you step on a tack or grab a hot pan or something. There's got to be a receptor for that particular stimulus. And then that receptor sends information to the central nervous system via this nerve right here. So what can you tell me about the nature of this information going through this neuron right here? What is that? Yeah, it's afferent. But give me the name of that information. What is that that's traveling along that nerve right there? I'll give you a hint. It's made up of depolarizations and repolarizations. What is that? What is that stuff going through this neuron right here? That's an action potential. Yeah, that's an action potential, which is when that action potential moves along this neuron, we call that a nerve impulse. And so all those changes in sodium and potassium are taking place right there. And since this neuron is bringing information to the central nervous system, we call that a what kind of neuron? You could say sensory or afferent, right? Because it's bringing information into the nervous system. And as it's bringing it to the nervous system, it can only enter the spinal cord. Here's a cross-section of a spinal cord right here. There's two ways. It can either enter or leave. This posterior or dorsal, what we call root, or this anterior or ventral root. And sensory information always goes in which way? Through this dorsal root right here. So the dorsal root is 100% sensory. There are no motor signals in that particular root right there. So these action potentials come into the spinal cord. They excite a neuron inside the spinal cord, so we call that an interneuron. And then it directly excites a motor neuron, namely to the hamstrings right over here that are going to cause the hamstrings to contract and pull your foot away from that obnoxious stimulus, that noxious stimulus. So that's then, so the effector would be this muscle, and the response would be what? Withdrawal from that particular stimulus. So let's go over the parts one more time. Let's see, I probably have, is that on page 7? I don't know, do I have it on a page? Ah, you know what? It's on page 7. Okay, so these are the steps of a reflex arc right here. Stimulus, sensory receptor, right? Sensory neuron, dorsal root ganglia, dorsal root association neuron, ventral root motor neuron effector, and that leads to a response. So you should be able to match these things up with this figure right here. So the TAC is the stimulus, and you have a receptor right there to feel that stimulus, and then you have this sensory neuron going past the dorsal root ganglia into the dorsal root where it synapses on that interneuron, and that stimulates a motor neuron going to this effector organ, which is going to cause a response, right? So it's all right there. Okay, so that's it for reflex. The next thing are the meninges. The meninges are a system of membranes around your brain that protect your brain. Because what can you tell me about nervous tissue, like your brain? It is delicate. I like that term. I've never used that term. But it's true. It's very delicate. It doesn't have any bones in there, right? It's just nervous tissue, and it can be damaged pretty easily, like in trauma, like in motorcycle accidents or car accidents and things like that. All right, but there's something that protects the brain. There's a special number of layers around the brain that does a really good job in protecting it, and that's called the meninges. And I don't know if anybody in here has played football in recent history, but it used to be, back when I was growing up, that football helmets were like leather shoes that you'd put on your head. Okay, just like leather, not very hard. And then they got kind of sophisticated and they started making them out of plastic, which was hard, so you could like hit your head up against a table and you wouldn't feel it, right? And but nowadays, football helmets are really sophisticated because not only do they have plastic on an outer shell, but they have a bunch of stuff on the inside. They have special kinds of cushions. They have little pillows that you can inflate with air, and other kinds of pillows that have water in them, water, so that when the helmet gets hit, the water squishes from one little pillow to another pillow, and that absorbs the shock when somebody hits their head. And so that really prevents a lot of head injuries because of that. And that helmet is really modeled after the meninges in your brain right here, because the meninges of your brain have different compartments filled with fluid and different structural components that help protect your brain from trauma. All right, so the three main layers of the meninges is called the dura mater. The next deeper one, so this is from superficial to deep. You got the dura mater, and then the next one is the arachnoid, and then the deepest one is called the pia mater. And the toughest one is the dura. That's like leather. It's impossible to rip unless you have a really sharp pair of scissors or scalpel or something. Yeah, it is durable. I've never used that term in lecture either, but I like it. Okay, even though your brain is delicate, it's surrounded by something that is very durable, and that's the dura mater. Okay. All right, so let's see if I can show you a picture. We said the dura is what? The deep layer or the superficial layer? That's the superficial layer. So you got a really good picture in your book. So here is, for instance, a coronal section through somebody's brain, and we can see brain and spinal cord. And the blue represents cerebral spinal fluid. That's the fluid that is really suspending your brain. Your brain is floating in that fluid right here. All right, but let's look at this close-in section right here. And we can see the dura mater is this white layer right here. Now, white layer. And does that look like the most superficial? Indeed it is. That's the first layer you get to after you get through bone. That's that leathery layer. The next layer, right after that, is the arachnoid. Now, I said white. Is the dura mater really white? Is that white? That layer right there? Yeah? Okay, and the one underneath it, and I have no idea, looks gray. Purple? Oh, you guys are kidding me. All right, the one that layered the arachnoid right here, this layer right here, what's that? Purple? Oh, it is purple. Okay, so the white is the dura, that's the strongest one. Then the arachnoid, that's another layer. Okay, the purple layer right here. All right, and then the last layer, which we call the pia mater. And the arachnoid is pretty strong, but not as strong as a dura mater. But the pia mater is as delicate as the brain. It's like tissue paper. It is damaged very easily. But you can see the pia mater follows every little convolution in the brain, every little dip. It actually is layered right on top of the brain, very, very closely. Follows every little curve. Right, but between the subarachnoid, or between the arachnoid and the pia, there's something called the subarachnoid space. And I see some connective tissue in there, some collagen fibers. But that's the space that contains cerebral spinal fluid. And that cerebral spinal fluid acts as a very important shock absorber, and it holds your brain just in the right position inside your head so that it doesn't move around. So these things then make up the meninges, the three membranes, namely what? The dura mater, the arachnoid, and then the pia mater. And in between the arachnoid and pia mater is the subarachnoid space with cerebral spinal fluid. Now, you don't have cerebral spinal fluid on this diagram right here in your book, so I won't ask you to name it, but you should probably know where that cerebral spinal fluid is. It's between the pia, which is right on the surface of the brain, and the arachnoid. And so, a good way to talk about this space right here, because it's below the arachnoid, it's deep to the arachnoid, we like to call it subarachnoid space. So the subarachnoid space is filled with cerebral spinal fluid. Okay? And all of these hold the brain in place, so that it doesn't slosh around. Or if you do get your head hit by something, right, it can absorb a lot of shock, and this fluid is going to squirt around in there. But that's better than what? Your brain squirting around in there. You don't want your brain squirting around anywhere. It's okay for that fluid to make adjustments, but you don't want that brain to squish and deform and go various places. So it could happen. Okay, and that dura mater we see in the brain, the dura mater goes where? Not just the brain, but goes all the way down and covers everything in the spinal cord. And you have the pia mater and the arachnoid doing the exact same thing in the spinal cord that you see around the brain. And as a matter of fact, you even have some cerebral spinal fluid going down between the arachnoid and the pia mater of the spinal cord. Okay. Now, so that's the meninges. What do you call an infection of this space right here, of that cerebral spinal fluid? Have you ever heard of that? That would be called meningitis. That's an inflammation of the meninges. And would you guess that's a pretty serious condition? Yeah, because your brain is controlling everything in your body. And if that gets diseased, or if your temperature goes up, then you're going to lose control over your whole body. So meningitis is very serious and deadly. And one of the ways to tell if you have meningitis is actually to get some cerebral spinal fluid and take a look and see if there's any bacteria in there. Or maybe you could do a test for viruses. Right? And what do you call that when you take cerebral spinal fluid out of somebody? Has anybody ever had any CSF taken out of you? Maybe not. I hope not. Oh yeah, you have? Okay. Not a lot of fun. But where they do that, right? We said that these membranes are continuous with the spinal cord, so you have CSF going all the way down into the spinal cord. Right, let's take a look at this slide right here that shows your brain and spinal cord. So if you have meningitis, it's an inflammation of what? Your whole brain and spinal cord. But a good place to get cerebral spinal fluid is not from somebody's brain, right? Because you have to drill a hole through somebody's cranium to get to it. But you can actually put a needle between the vertebrae and draw it out from a lumbar region, for instance. And it's called a lumbar puncture or spinal tap. And you can aspirate a little bit of cerebral spinal fluid out that way for analysis. Okay. And I don't know all the procedures with that. My guess is probably I would like to be unconscious when that happens. But I don't think... Yeah, but typically it's done with an awake patient, and maybe because they need you to tell them if they're doing something bad. Okay? Huh? They need you to bend over and to behave just right so anesthesia is not used, and maybe to scream a lot if something bad is happening. Okay, so anesthesia is not preferred because maybe there could be some damage or something won't happen just right if they use anesthesia. Okay. Okay, who's got a question on the meninges? Did I cover everything on the meninges? Where's my meninges? Yeah, just remember those three layers, the dura, the arachnoid, and the pia. The pia is the weakest, and it's tightly bound to the surface of the brain. A little bit separated from the pia is the arachnoid, and you have the CSF between the arachnoid and the pia. And then the toughest one is the durable layer, the dura mater. Okay? And the meninges surrounds the brain as well as the spinal cord, all the way down to the cord. Okay. So that's meninges. And I don't think you have another slide in your book regarding that. Okay. So let's get away from central nervous system, right? Because we were talking about brain and spinal cord. Talk about peripheral nervous system a little bit. Okay. So what's the function of the peripheral nervous system? Well, it's got two functions. One is sensory and one is motor. So for the sensory function, which way do signals go? For sensory, they go into the central nervous system. So it's from the periphery to CNS. Then motor, on the other hand, is what? It's got to be the opposite. It's got to go from the central nervous system issuing commands to some effector organs like muscles and glands in your periphery. So that would be a motor type signal. Okay. Furthermore, the motor part of the central nervous system, or the motor part of the peripheral nervous system, has two divisions. It has a somatic part and an autonomic part. What the heck does that mean? Somatic is what we say, voluntary. So these nerves go to skeletal muscles. These are parts of your body that you definitely have control over. Skeletal muscle. You can contract these skeletal muscles. And we call that somatic because usually the somatic regions of your body are the superficial regions, as opposed to regions that are deep, that contain your viscera, like your lungs and your heart and digestive glands and things like that. So somatic means kind of superficial. And also from the motor system, it would be voluntary. The other part of the motor nervous system is autonomic. And those autonomic nerves go to glands. Give me a name of a gland. Thyroid gland. Thymus. Adrenal gland. And is that similar to, for instance, your biceps? You can control your biceps. You can pick up a glass of water or something willfully, but can you willfully control your thyroid gland or your thymus gland or your adrenal gland? Or maybe it's not even an endocrine gland. How about a salivary gland? You can't really control that, except maybe with some kind of trick you could control it. Okay. Yeah. Like if I think of pizza, I probably can start salivating or something, but that's just a little trick. All right, so those kinds of glands you don't have control over, and those get nerves from your autonomic nervous system. And the same thing for your heart. You don't have voluntary control of your heart. It just beats at its own little rhythm, depending on the activities that you're going through. But just like that example with the salivary gland, you can influence your heart rate, for instance, by thinking certain kinds of thoughts. Like you could think very peaceful thoughts and go into meditation and slow your heart rate down, for instance. Or, for instance, if you had a real nasty teacher, he could control your heart rate by saying, what? Okay, pop quiz. I'm going to surprise you with a quiz right now, so put your books away. And that would influence your heart rate, but that's not really you controlling your heart. That's just you influencing your autonomic nervous system, for instance. And then as well, smooth muscle, autonomic nervous system goes to smooth muscle to help control blood vessel diameter and pupil diameter in your eye, for instance, or contractions of a uterus or fallopian tubes and things like that. And I'm sure a lot of people wish that they could have voluntary control over uterine contractions, but you just don't. Okay? even no matter how hard maybe you even meditate, you really don't have control over such things. Okay, so that's the functional organization of the peripheral nervous system. Now let's look at the structural organization of the peripheral nervous system, and that is you have two kinds of nerves leaving the central nervous system. You have cranial nerves and spinal nerves. And guess where those spinal nerves come from? Your spinal cord. And that's why we call them spinal nerves. I sure hope I have some slides of this stuff right here. Okay, you have some spinal nerves. And the cranial nerves, guess where the cranial nerves come from? Your cranium. And don't forget, what is your cranium? The cranium is your brain. Oh, I found another good slide on cerebral spinal fluid. I'll show you in a little bit. Okay, so for instance, I showed you a reflex. Here's that reflex. Here's a cross section of the spinal cord. All right, so this is at some level, maybe a lumbar level or something like that. And what are the two ways in and out of the spinal cord? You've got the dorsal root, which is sensory, and then the ventral root, which is motor. So these are signals leaving. So these are what we call spinal nerves because they're leaving your central nervous system by your spine. Right? So a spinal nerve has two roots, the dorsal and the ventral root. Okay. Now, the other kind leave your brain. And those we call cranial nerves. You have 12 pairs of cranial nerves that leave the brain. So here is a really good picture of the brain. And in yellow are all the cranial nerves. And it looks pretty confusing. There's a whole bunch of them right here. There are 12 all together. And they're labeled 1 through 12 going from anterior to posterior. So once you know the organization, it's not too bad. For instance, this is number 1, here's number 2, here's number 3, right? Then 4, 5, okay, on down the line. But they also have names. I'm not going to ask you to know the names except for a couple of them. Okay, so the ones that I want you to know are number 1, number 2, right, number 10, which is over here. So the first one, way up over here in the most anterior part of your brain, that's the olfactory nerve. What's that sense of olfaction called? That smell. That's what it means, not what it's called. It means smell, the sense of smell. And then optic nerve right here. That is for vision. That's for visual information. So these nerves are sensory nerves. They bring in information into your central nervous system. The vagus, number 10, all the way down over here, is important because, well, it has both. It has both sensory and motor information in it. But more importantly, the vagus nerve is good because it goes to your heart and it slows your heart down. So the vagus is part of the parasympathetic nerves to your heart. Parasympathetic. I'm going to mention that again toward the end of the lecture for today. Parasympathetic nervous system. So the vagus is one of the most important for that particular purpose. So those are the three. And then I remembered, I do want to tell you one other real important nerve. But we have to go back up to spinal nerves. Okay, and we don't have a picture, so I'm going to draw it in. All right, so these are all cranial nerves. You got to know olfactory, optic, and the vagus, number 10. 1, 2, and 10. All right, here's that picture of the brain and spinal cord again. So what kind of nerves leave this part of your central nervous system? Okay. Of the two kinds. Let me put that slide back up. Here's that slide. What are the two kinds of nerves? By structure, you have cranial and spinal. So of these two divisions, cranial and spinal, nerves that leave that area that I circled right there are what? What's this right here? This is your spine. So down here is where you have your spinal nerves leaving, but up over here you have your cranial nerves leaving. Oh, but they could be either way. They could be sensory or motor. Either cranial nerves or spinal nerves, they could be either motor or sensory. All right. What we say cranial or spinal is just by where they leave the central nervous system. And since this is the cranium right here, the nerves that leave the cranium, we call those cranial nerves. And since these nerves leave the spinal cord, we call those spinal nerves. Right? And of the cranial nerves, how many are there? You should probably know how many there are. There's 12. Right? There's 12 altogether. And you got to know the first two and the 10th one, the name of those, and the function. The first one is olfactory, which is function, smell. Number two is optic, which is vision, sight. Okay, and then number 10, which is way down over here someplace, that's the name, what's the name of number 10? The vagus, and I'm going to tell you what it does. It does a number of different things, but one thing that you should remember is that it slows the heart rate down. It slows your heart rate. Namely because it is part of the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay. Oh, I do have it on this sheet. The one thing I wanted to tell you down over here, and I'll get to that in just a second. All right, so cranial nerves, they can be purely sensory, like vision, the optic nerve or olfactory nerve, purely sensory, has no motor nerves in it whatsoever, only afferent information. Sometimes they're motor only. It means it goes to skeletal muscle in the head or neck, like the oculomotor nerve. That's number three. You don't have to know that one. All right? And then sometimes they're mixed. They have both functions. Now, how does that relate to this condition over here, the fourth condition, where it contains both sensory and motor? How does that relate to a spinal nerve? Or spinal root, actually, would be a better way of saying that. What's a spinal root? Here's the spinal root, here's the dorsal, here's the ventral. What can you tell me about that dorsal spinal root right there? It is 100% what? Sensory. Yeah, it's 100% afferent. There's no motor signals in it. So that's a distinction that spinal roots have with some cranial nerves, because some cranial nerves are what? They can be both motor and sensory, but a spinal root is what? Either one or the other. It's either sensory or motor, but it's never mixed. Okay? So that's a pretty important distinction. Because, for instance, if somebody hurt their back and maybe they have a slipped disc or something, and it's impinging a nerve coming out of their spinal cord, one of their spinal nerves, they might experience a sensory deficit. They might not be able to perceive certain parts of their body. All right? And if that's the case, you don't even have to do any imaging studies. You know exactly what root it is. So the question then for you is, if somebody has loss of sensation from some part of their body, what root is it? Is it the dorsal root or the ventral root? It's the dorsal root. Okay, so we know that the intervertebral disc somehow is impinging on this part over here. But if they have normal function, right, then it is not the ventral root. But now let's just say that a person feels fine all over their body. They feel fine, but maybe now they have a motor deficit. Maybe when they walk, for instance, they can't lift their toes up off the ground. What do you call it when you lift your toes off the ground? It's a kind of flexion. What kind of flexion? That is what we call dorsiflexion. When you point your toes into the ground, that's plantar flexion. So when somebody cannot dorsiflex, they're going to do what with their toes or their shoes? Yeah, they're going to drag the tips of their shoes along the ground, and their shoes are going to wear out, and their toes will wear out if they don't wear shoes, but most people wear shoes or something. Okay, and what happens when you drag your toes across the ground? What's going to happen? You're going to trip. Okay, and then you're going to fall and maybe break a hip or something, which is hard on you, right? That's very hard to break a major bone. So if somebody has a motor deficit, what root is it that's damaged? Is it the dorsal root or the ventral root right here? It's going to be this ventral root, because that's the motor nerve right there. So just by knowing how people walk tells us a lot about, okay, for instance, a spinal cord injury. And I promised that earlier in the class I would tell you about that. Okay, so just by looking at somebody's shoes, you can tell what? Dorsal root or ventral root problem. Or just by the way somebody walks. You know, a trained physician can tell a lot of neuroanatomy, how it's functioning on you, just by knowing the architecture of the nervous system right here. I find that pretty amazing. Who's got a question on that? All right, so some cranial nerves are mixed, but the roots are what? Always one or the other, either sensory or motor. The dorsal root or ventral root is just one or the other. Okay. All right, so some are, other cranial nerves are parasympathetic motor. What is the one that I mentioned that you have to know that's parasympathetic motor? The vagus, number 10. All right, like it goes to cardiac muscle. And then write down in your notes, what is the effect on your heart of parasympathetic stimulation on your heart? Yeah, it's going to be inhibitory. It's going to slow the heart rate down. So parasympathetic on your heart, decrease HR. And that HR stands for? Heart rate. Yeah, it's going to decrease your heart rate. Okay. Let's just talk about one last thing, spinal nerve function. So spinal nerves, well, remember, roots are either what? Sensory or motor, but never both, right? They're never both. It's going to be one or the other. But remember those two roots, what do? When they get out into the periphery, these two roots right here, so here's the dorsal root, sensory, here's the ventral root, motor, they do what? They come together. And when they come together, then they have both what? Motor and sensory. So the nerve itself going someplace in your body is always mixed, but the root is one or the other. Okay. What's that real important muscle that you use for breathing? Yeah, your diaphragm. And that's a skeletal muscle. Separates your thoracic cavity from your abdominal cavity. And when it contracts, you inhale. And when it relaxes, you exhale. That's how we get air in and out of our lungs. There's a nerve that goes to the diaphragm. And that's called the phrenic nerve. Can you read that? P-H-R-E-N-I-C. Phrenic nerve. It goes to the diaphragm. And your diaphragm is skeletal muscle, so it's under voluntary control. Okay, guess what happens if that phrenic nerve gets damaged? Can't breathe. What's that like? That is horrible. Right? If you can't breathe for yourself, then somebody has to breathe for you. And I always check to see who can breathe for me in here. Who can breathe for me in here? Who's certified to do that? You are certified to do that. And what do we call that certification? That's called CPR, right? Cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And you can breathe for somebody by what? Well, by not chest compressions, that's beating somebody's heart, but yeah, just mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. All right, if that phrenic nerve gets damaged. Now, where does that phrenic nerve come from? It's got to come a long way to get to the diaphragm. So let's just look. Let's look back on this diagram right over here. Your diaphragm is about, let's see, lumbar. This kind of looks like thoracic right over here. So between thoracic and abdominal compartment, I would say your diaphragm is about in this location right here. And it's kind of curved like that so that when it contracts, it flattens out and that sucks air into your lungs. All right, and this nerve comes from way up over here. Okay, these are cervical vertebrae, 1, 2, 3. There's a root that can leave here. Here's 4. A root can leave here, and 5 can leave here. And then they all come together like this, and it goes to your diaphragm. So this is that phrenic nerve. Right there. Okay? You don't know if you can draw that, but that's okay. So this is C3, C4, and C5. So that's the space between the third and fourth, between the second and third, the third and fourth and fifth vertebrae in your neck, and that goes all the way down to your phrenic, down to your diaphragm. Okay, that's your phrenic nerve, huh? Yeah, so here's your diaphragm. I'll tell you a little trick on how to remember that. Diaphragm. Okay, so you'll have to share that. And I can't say her name because I'm recording. But she told me she had to leave early today, so she's going to study with somebody. Remember to tell her this little trick. So there's that diaphragm. Okay, so how do you know that it's the roots from C3, 4, and 5 that go to the diaphragm down here that allow you to breathe? The little saying is, C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. Right? Because without these nerves right here, you can't breathe. So if you get a cervical spine injury at this level right here, where you have no communication of your brain down to the spinal cord at C3, 4, and 5, then you no longer have control of the diaphragm, and you're going to die real quick. Okay? Unless there's somebody there that can breathe for you. Now, how fast are you going to die if nobody's there?
4 to 10 minutes.
Okay. 4 minutes. Okay. When will your brain go unconscious? After how? 4 seconds. And then when is your brain going to be dead?
4 minutes.
4 minutes. Except for me, it's how long? It's about, a couple hours, right? Okay. So 4 minutes. You have to make sure that, if you're certified, you're paying attention, you can help people out, huh? You got your mask with you. That's fantastic. It's a little barrier device that you can put over somebody's mouth, so when you do mouth to mouth, you don't get infected by whatever the person has. Okay. Or vice versa. Maybe you have a bad cold that you don't want to give to somebody else. The barrier device will help you as well. And then. Okay. So what's the beauty of this system? Well, it's evolved to where, what happens if you have a spinal cord injury between C3 and C4? Can you still breathe? Yeah, because there are still branches from C3 that can go all the way down to the diaphragm. This is what we call a plexus, and a plexus just allows nerve signals to take alternate routes to get to an effector organ. Yeah. If you have damage further down, okay, like down over here, maybe at level C6 or C7, that phrenic nerve is just fine because it only needs C3, C4, and C5. Now, the phrenic nerve is going to be in big trouble if you have a cervical spine injury at C2 or C1, right? Then there's no input at all here to the phrenic nerve. If you have damage way down over here, okay, then you'll be able to breathe just fine. You'll have good control over your arms, but you won't have control over your legs. So that's why that person would be a paraplegic. But if you have damage up over here, right above the thoracic region, okay, you'll be able to breathe, but you'll be a quadriplegic. You won't have control over your arms or your legs. So depending on where the lesion is in the spinal cord, everything below that region, right, you won't have control over. Okay, which is definitely sad, because we don't know how to regenerate that spinal cord yet. Maybe in a couple years we'll figure out how to do it. But right now we don't really know how to regenerate those nerves that are going through the spinal cord. Okay, and that's part of the controversy of stem cell research, because people believe that with certain kinds of stem cells we might be able to rebuild a nervous system. But most good stem cells come from embryos, right? And an embryo is a viable, some people believe they're a viable organism, and you're killing a human being when you kill an embryo. Okay, and it's kind of beyond the scope of this course for me to talk about that, but that's it's a really deep issue, but, I'm not in favor of killing human life. Okay. Okay, so that is that spinal nerve. And what else? Number 8. What about slide number 9? Is that my last slide? Do you have a page 9? Page 9? Maybe that's it. Let me look at my notes. Oh, I thought we had parasympathetic and autonomic nervous system. Okay, I got to find it. I got to find it because it's fun. No number 9 there. No, 6. 7. Okay. Here we go. Okay. Autonomic nervous system. Go back to that very front page. What are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? Yep, you got the sympathetic and parasympathetic, or vice versa. I don't really care. All right. You can say them in either order, I don't care. And I don't really care too much that you know how each of these function, but I want you to be really sure on how they function with regard to each other. That's one of the most important things to realize. And that is the sympathetic nervous system is antagonistic to the parasympathetic nervous system, which means what? They always work with each other or against each other. They work against each other. Right now, is that usually a good thing or a bad thing in terms of everyday life, being antagonistic? Usually it's a bad thing, right? You don't like to be around antagonistic people, like, what are you doing that for? Or, get up now. No, I don't want to get up now. Okay? But in terms of a control system, that's a very good thing for systems to work against each other. For instance, think of your automobile. Name two parts of your automobile that you want to have that work against each other, but you definitely want to have them when you go home tonight. Yeah, the gas pedal and the brake pedal. You step on one, the car goes. You step on the other, the car stops. So what's the beauty of that? Well, because you have a go pedal and a stop pedal, if you mix them just right, what do you have? You can go just a certain speed to maintain a speed limit. All right, or for instance, if you only had a gas pedal and you went home, what would happen when you got home? Well, you'd have to wave goodbye, right? Because you couldn't stop. Yeah, you could just jump out and let the car keep going. All right, so antagonistic systems are really good because you get precise control and balance. All right, so precise control and balance. And I think I gave you that example once before, Friday night, you know, if you get stopped, pulled over by the person with the really nice blue uniform and the fancy badge and sidearm, you want to have nice antagonistic control of your biceps and triceps so you can put your finger on the tip of your nose without poking the policeman in the eye or yourself in the eye or anything like that. So your your autonomic nervous system is based on antagonism. If the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory on a particular organ, the parasympathetic is going to be what? Inhibitory. Or if the sympathetic is inhibitory on a certain organ, what's the parasympathetic? It's going to be stimulatory. So it's not always true that the sympathetic is stimulatory or inhibitory. The only thing you know for sure, if one is one way, then the other is the other way. They're going to be antagonistic to each other. Okay, and that's a really good thing because then you have precise control over various parts of your body. So those two divisions are what? The parasympathetic and the sympathetic. Let's talk about the parasympathetic first. All right, where does the parasympathetic nervous system come from? Different parts of your body. It comes from different parts of your brain and spinal cord. It comes from your brain stem, that's part of your brain. Right, that's one of the lower parts of your brain, and spinal cord in the sacrum. Sacrum 2, 3, at levels 2, 3, and 4. Where's your sacrum? way down over here. So your parasympathetic innervation comes from way up at your brain or way down over here at your sacrum. So sometimes we actually call that craniosacral outflow. Parasympathetic is craniosacral, which is, it's just kind of strange because usually you think, what, nerves can leave your central nervous system anywhere from your cranial nerves or spinal nerves, but not true for a parasympathetic nervous system. It's only craniosacral. And here is a really good diagram in your book. It maybe looks a little complicated, but it's not bad. Where do you see nerves? These are parasympathetic nerves. Where are these nerves leaving your central nervous system? It's either way up here at the brain or way down here at the sacrum. And is there anything in between? Nothing. Okay? And these nerves can go all over your body, all right, like to your eye or your heart or whatever, or your digestive tract, and they do. But they can only leave cranial or sacrally. Cranial, sacral. Yeah. You know what? I don't have the exact figure in your book, but I got figure 9.35. This might be 9.36 or 7 in your book, because this is from edition number 8. Okay? 3.6? 3.36. Page 241. All right, so here's a good diagram of the outflow of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is what? Cranial sacral. Okay. Let's contrast this a little bit with the sympathetic nervous system. So here's sympathetic nervous system. The cell bodies and outflow go from the spinal cord from levels T1 to L2. T1 is thoracic, which is this level here, and L2 is way down over here. But these are definitely what? Spinal cord regions. So if you look at, and here's the probably the next figure in your book, if you look at sympathetic outflow, it's not from the cranium. It's not from the sacrum, because that's parasympathetic nervous system. It's from what? It's a thoracic and lumbar, and sometimes we call that thoracolumbar outflow. Thoracolumbar. What question? Oh, wow, I don't know what question we're on. Okay, that's okay. But I'm sure this is a question. Okay, I'm sure we'll go over it in a little bit.
Okay.
All right, so this is the sympathetic nervous system, and you can see it goes to the heart, it goes to the eye. Okay, so let's see, what's important here? In order for information to go from your central nervous system to effector organ, no matter what it is, it takes two nerves to do that. Right? If it's just a regular voluntary nerve, it's just one nerve all the way from your central nervous system to a muscle, say like your biceps. But if it's an autonomic nerve, it takes two to get there. All right. So here is some sympathetic nerves going to your heart. Sympathetic nerves, does anybody know if it's going to be excitatory or inhibitory on the heart? And I give you a hint. I'm going to take the sympathetic off and put the parasympathetic on. All right, so here's a parasympathetic nerve going to the heart. Is that ringing a bell? It slows the heart rate down. Okay. So decreases heart rate. That's the parasympathetic. Now, what's the effect of sympathetic going to be? It's going to be opposite, right? So I'm going to slide off the parasympathetic, put on the sympathetic nervous system. And here I see a bunch of sympathetic nerves going to the heart. What's the effect going to be? It's not going to be a down arrow. It's going to be an up arrow on heart rate. Now, does that seem really silly to have both going to your heart? No more silly than it is to have a gas pedal and a brake pedal on your car, because you want to have precise control and balance over your heart rate. Okay? So that's the importance of the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. All right, but generally speaking, what can we say about these two divisions? Oh, one last thing I want to say. So in your notes, you got all these different things, digestion, defecation, urination, respiration. on the test, I think I would only pick one. I would pick the effects on the heart. And now you know both of them. Or maybe I could tell you the effects of parasympathetic nervous system on digestion is stimulatory. What's the effect of the sympathetic system? Which way? If digestion is enhanced by parasympathetic, what's going to happen with sympathetic stimulation? It's going to inhibit, right? Because they're going to be antagonistic to each other. I maybe would ask you that. But the only one for sure I'm going to ask you absolutely is this cardiac right here. Parasympathetic decreases, sympathetic increases. Furthermore, what's the nerve for decreasing heart rate? Give me the name of the cranial nerve and the number. That would be a good one. That's vagus, that's number 10. Vagus number 10. Vagus? Is that what you said? Number X. Vagus number X. Okay, because that's parasympathetic. Now, here's something, though, I would like you to know. Information is transmitted through a nerve as an electrical signal. But between nerves, or between a nerve and the effector organ, like between the nerve and the heart, it's got to be a chemical signal because there's a synapse there. So there's got to be a chemical that goes from the nerve to the effector organ, and we call that chemical a neurotransmitter. Okay, the neurotransmitter for the parasympathetic nervous system is one we call acetylcholine. The neurotransmitter for the sympathetic nervous system is norepinephrine. And you could also think of maybe epinephrine. All right, so the common name, actually the old English name for epinephrine is adrenaline. Probably you all have heard of adrenaline. What happens if you get a shot of adrenaline? What happens to your heart rate? It goes way up, right? So epinephrine or norepinephrine are going to have the same effect on the heart. It's going to speed the heart rate up. All right, but on the other hand, you have chemicals in your body that will slow the heart rate down. So if we want to compare these two different nervous systems, we can make a little comparison. The sympathetic nervous system is what we say elicits a fight or flight response. Fight, F-I-G-H-T, or flight, F-L-I-G-H-T. F-I-G-H-T or F-L-I-G-H-T, fight or flight. Now, people can't fly, but if you're really scared, you can still run away. That's what we mean by flight, right? Okay. So with sympathetic stimulation, that's going to, I don't have an eyeball right here. I should have an eyeball right here. It's going to dilate your iris. It's going to make your pupils really big so you can take in a whole bunch of light to perceive the threat maybe that's in your environment. Your heart rate is going to speed up. Blood vessels in your muscles are going to vasodilate, so a lot of blood can go to muscles to give muscles oxygen and glucose so that they can work very, very hard. Right, that's the fight or flight response. The parasympathetic nervous system, on the other hand, is what we call the rest and repose. Rest and repose. Or rest and digest. Okay? Because what? Parasympathetic is stimulatory on the digestive system, but sympathetic is inhibitory on digestion. So there's two different nervous systems that are controlling your body. And maybe let's just do a little meditation to have you experience these two different nervous systems. Now you're rolling your eyes. Okay, so let's pretend that it's after school right now, you're at work, okay? And it's not very busy in the store. As a matter of fact, you don't have any customers at all. All right, so what do when you have nothing to do? Well, and you left your cell phone at home, you could take a nap, or probably more likely you're going to take out your physiology book and you're going to start reading physiology and working all the questions, okay? And so how do you feel after working all the physiology questions for the quiz next time? You feel really tired and you want to take a nap, but actually before then you're going to feel really good. You've accomplished something, right? You have this feeling of accomplishment, and you look around the store and there's still no customers. So you're still what? Really, are you really apprehensive or relaxed?
Relaxed.
You're relaxed, right? Okay, so furthermore, now it's time for closing. You had only a few customers, and you balanced out the cash register, and all the receipts match how much money you have in the cash register, so you don't owe anybody any money, which is really good. Now how do you feel? Really good, right? Because now you don't have to put in $10 or $20 to make everything match up just right. And you got your homework done, and everything is looking really good. So you feel what? You feel good. All right, so then you got to lock up, and you get your keys together and everything, and you step outside, right, and you put the key in the lock, and you turn the lock, and you take a step outside, and then you notice, oh, all the streetlights are out. Now how do you feel? Maybe a little kind of anxious because it's pitch black outside and you can't see what's happening. All right, so now your mood is what? It's changing a little bit. Okay, and so then you take a couple steps and you kind of look at the parking lot and you can't really see your car. And then you remember, oh, the parking lot was full when I got to work tonight and I had to park three blocks away. Okay, now how do you feel? The lights are out and you got to walk across this neighborhood and who knows, it's not your home neighborhood. Okay, so now how do you feel?
Really uptight.
Really uptight. What's happening to your heart rate?
Going up.
It's going up a little bit. Okay, so you start walking down the sidewalk to get to your car, and you hear some behind you. Now what's happening to your heart rate? No, you're not falling asleep. Okay. So now you're scared, and so what's happening to your heart rate? It is? It's increasing, right? What about your respirations? Definitely up. What about your eyes, the pupils of your eyes? They're dilated. They're looking around. So what nervous system now is being activated? Sympathetic or parasympathetic? That's your sympathetic nervous system, right? While you're all happy and content in the store, what nervous system was predominant? Was your parasympathetic nervous system, okay? And then those footsteps get closer and closer and closer to you. And then you hear my voice saying, oh, hi. I hope you had a good evening. And I'm glad your homework is all done. Okay, and so then you're not anxious at all anymore. Okay, so there's a difference in parasympathetic versus sympathetic nervous system, and guess which one you pay the big bucks to go get stimulated when you see a movie? Sympathetic, yeah. You don't pay $25 to go see a movie that's going to stimulate your parasympathetic nervous system, right? You're going to go pay whoever the director is, Spielberg or whatever, that have learned all kinds of tricks to stimulate your what? Your sympathetic nervous system. You're watching a movie, your eyes are all dilated and everything, your heart rate is up, and you're nice and awake that way. All right, so that's the last bit for nervous system, the difference between the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system. If you're going to take home one message of the autonomic nervous system, namely the difference between parasympathetic and sympathetic, what is that? What would you take home? How would you describe the relationship between those two nervous systems? Yeah, they're antagonistic to each other, right? They work in opposite directions, but that's really a good thing. All right, should we work on some of these questions for the test? Probably a test coming up one of these days. Okay, what are the two most general divisions of the nervous system? Two most general. We have? I like central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. Wait. Okay, the two most general, central and peripheral nervous system, and you should know how to define those. What are the two divisions of the central nervous system?
Brain
and spinal cord. Now, if you say sensory and motor, that's not really bad. Okay? Afferent and efferent, that's not really bad. But for this particular question, I think I was after more a structural organization, not so much functional. So if it's structural, I would say brain and spinal cord. If it's functional, maybe I would say motor and sensory. Okay? What are the two divisions of the peripheral nervous system? Ah, now, let's say in terms of function. How about for peripheral nervous system, I would say motor and sensory. In that case, I would say motor and sensory, or afferent and efferent. What two categories are the motor division classified into? Motor, meaning you're controlling different peripheral parts of your body. Two different ways. Somatic, I like that, which is a fancy way of saying voluntary versus autonomic. So those are the two. Somatic versus autonomic of the peripheral nervous system. All right. Furthermore, what are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? You got sympathetic and parasympathetic, and they're antagonistic to each other. Okay. Okay, let's see if I know any of these other ones. I didn't read this over before class. It always stimulates my sympathetic nervous system, because I don't know if I know the answers. Name the two types of cells which make up the nervous system. Two general kinds of cells. I can do it. Neurons and neuroglia. Name the type of cell which is specialized for the transmission of nerve impulses. Is it neurons or neuroglia?
Neurons.
It's going to be those neurons. Okay. All right. Then name the parts of a neuron. Okay. The parts of a neuron in terms of, let's start with the part of a neuron that receives information.
Dendrite.
That would be the dendrite. And then that information goes to the?
Axon.
I like cell body next. Cell body. So dendrite, cell body, and then axon. Yep, and a signal will go in that direction. You might know some other parts in between, but those are the three major parts. What is the name of the chemical that a Schwann cell synthesizes? Probably you should know what it does, too. Myelin is it. Myelin, and what does myelin do? It is an insulator. It prevents electrical currents from leaving the nerve cell. And let's see. What does it do? What does a myelin sheath do on a nerve? Oh, geez, I hope I told you. What good is a myelin sheath on a nerve axon? Yeah, it does that jumpy thing. That means it speeds up the speed of conduction down the axon. It speeds propagation. So myelinated nerves are fast. Non-myelinated nerves are slow. And it really helps if you have fast neurons, because you can get out of the way of things faster. Know the definition of gray matter. White matter, nucleus, ganglion, nerve tract. Ooh, wow. Okay, gray matter is? Yeah, it looks gray because it does not have myelin on it. And what parts of a neuron don't have myelin? It's the cell body, and it's the dendrites. So wherever you have a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, it looks gray because it doesn't have myelin around it. Cell bodies and dendrites. And then you got white matter. White matter has myelin around it. So those are myelinated axons. And a nucleus. Now it has to do with the nervous system, not a cell. A nucleus, everybody knows what the nucleus of a cell is, but a nucleus in the nervous system. Yep, it's a group, it's an area in the brain, or spinal cord, that is composed only of dendrites and nerve cell bodies. Dendrites and nerve cell bodies, just a little bunch of them. And what color does it look like then?
Gray.
Looks gray.
Yeah.
So you have this little gray spot someplace in the brain or spinal cord. And that little gray spot is going to be surrounded by white matter. What's white matter? White is myelinated something, is axons that are myelinated. So that's gray matter. Nerve cell bodies and dendrites are gray matter. White matter are axons that are myelinated, because myelin is white. Oh, and a nucleus is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. So it looks gray. Okay. I didn't mean for you to change it. But in particular, that a nucleus is in the central nervous system. It's in the brain. All right. For a ganglion, on the other hand, is the same thing as a nucleus, but it's in the peripheral nervous system. It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system. So it's pretty much exactly the same thing, but one is in the brain and the other's, okay, in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, and then lastly, a nerve tract. What the heck is a nerve tract? You have nerve? That's good too. Okay, a nerve, let me say what a nerve tract is. Nerve tract is white matter, so it's myelinated axons that are going someplace in the central nervous system. A tract is in the central nervous system, and a nerve is a bunch of myelinated axons going someplace in the peripheral nervous system. So do you see the analogy there between nucleus and ganglia, nerve and nerve tract? A nucleus and a tract are in the central nervous system, and a ganglion and a nerve are in the peripheral nervous system. Nerve tract is central nervous system, is in the CNS, and a nerve is in the peripheral nervous system. We just call it a little bit differently. Okay, now we talk about, we still got a couple of minutes left. What two ions are important for establishing the resting membrane potential or the battery nature of a cell? Sodium and potassium. Which ion is at a higher concentration outside the cell? Sodium. I don't know an easy way of remembering that. You just got to brute force remember that. Sodium is high outside. Unless you could tell me, somebody should tell me a little trick sometime. But sodium is on the outside. You just got to know it. And potassium is high where? Inside. That's number 9. Oh, I skipped one. Node of Ranvier. What is that node of Ranvier? Where do you find it? You find it, yeah, it's a gap in the myelin sheath that is around an axon someplace. So it's a myelinated axon, but it's that little gap. And that's what allows a nerve impulse to hop from gap to gap to gap, which makes that propagation fast. How about number 10? What are the names of the two events that make up an action potential? Depolarization and repolarization. Fantastic. And then what are the molecular events? Know what ions make up the two events. Depolarization is what? Sodium going in. And then repolarization is potassium moving out. Okay. So it's making sense to me. Hopefully it's making a little sense to you guys. Going over it one more time doesn't hurt. So what's a synapse? What the heck is a synapse? Yeah, it's the way that two cells communicate with each other. Yeah, it's the way that cells communicate with each other. It's a structural and functional unit of communication between cells. But you got to know some of the pieces of a synapse. So how is it best to think about this? First, how do you think about information being transmitted within a neuron? That's just that sodium and potassium moving in, causing a, yeah, action potential going down. That's electrical. So information is transmitted within a neuron as an electrical signal. Electrical signal. How is information transmitted between nerve cells? As a chemical signal. And what is a general, yes, and what's the general name of that chemical? It's a neurotransmitter. So the neurotransmitter goes from one cell to the other. So that answers the next question. What is a neurotransmitter? Neurotransmitters is how a synapse transmits information from one nerve to another. And then give me two examples of neurotransmitters. Acetylcholine is a good one. And norepinephrine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, how is it transmitted between nerve cells? The information as a neurotransmitter. There's a chemical that actually goes from one cell across the synapse to the next cell. And a synapse, I lost the number, number 11. What's your question? Number 11? What's a synapse? examples for neurotransmitter. I can think of two. Acetylcholine is a good example. Acetylcholine for the parasympathetic nervous system. On a good day. You know, a lot of people don't say acetylcholine. I don't know why I do. A lot of people say acetylcholine. Acetylcholine. You like an H in there? But it can be abbreviated capital A, capital C, little h for acetylcholine with a little L, right, with a little h, acetylcholine. That's a good example of a neurotransmitter. And then another one is what? Yeah, norepinephrine. Or epinephrine, and on a good day I can spell that one too.
Not a good day.
Why, is there an E on the end of it?
Yeah.
Okay, norepinephrine. Sometimes we just call this norepi or epi. All right, let's see what else. Give an example. We've got two examples. What are the four areas of the brain stem? And give a function of each. Brain stem. The very inferior part. Yeah, medulla oblongata. Above that is the pons. And then above that is the midbrain. So I got medulla, pons, midbrain. And then the fourth area would be maybe a combination of a couple of those areas. That's called the reticular activating system. Now let's think about functions. Huh? Reticular activating system. Now let's go over some functions. The medulla controls heart rate and respirations and maybe blood pressure, some autonomic things that you don't have to think about. And then, so that's the medulla. Controls heart rate, blood pressure, things like that. Then the pons acts as a relay center for sending information to the cerebellum. So it helps in balance. Pons, okay, midbrain. The midbrain, yeah, it allows you to understand where sound is coming from, and we call that localizing sound. You can say, well, it's coming from over here, or over there, or whatever. And the midbrain is also important so that your eye can track objects in space, maybe even fix on an object. Okay, so it can track objects. And then the reticular activating system. What's the reticular activating system good for? Yeah, staying awake. Okay. And if you can't stay awake no matter what, then it's a lesion in there someplace that's called narcolepsy. Right? Which you don't have narcolepsy, I'm sure. Okay, yeah, right. Okay, so that's brain stem. How about one more question? Should we do one more question? Okay, what are the two areas of the diencephalon and a function of each? The two areas are the thalamus and the hypothalamus below it. Hypo means below. So the thalamus, what does the thalamus do?
Body temperature.
That's a hypothalamus, I think. Hypothalamus is for controlling body temperature and thirst and some other kinds of automatic functions. It also controls the pituitary, which is a very important endocrine gland. So the hypothalamus controls a lot of your endocrine system. But the thalamus is kind of like a director. It directs signals to other parts of your brain. It directs sensory signals. So it's a relay center. It's a relay center. What's the largest part of your brain? The cerebrum, or the cerebral, yeah, the cerebrum. Cerebral hemispheres. And you shouldn't, let's see, what's a gyrus and a sulcus? If you put a gyrus and a sulcus together, what do you get?
Hills and valleys.
You get hills, well, one's a hill, one's a valley. If you put them together, you get a? You get a fold, but we don't want to call it a fold, and we don't want them called hills and valleys. We want to call them a gyrus is the top part, and the depression is the sulcus. And if we put a gyrus and a sulcus together, that gives a? That gives us a gyrus-sulcus combination, which we call a convolution. Convolution. Yeah, I'm still awake. Convolution is a sulcus and a gyrus when you put them together. Okay, should we stop there? Okay, let's stop there. So try to identify the four lobes and tell me where to start next time. Okay, the questions for the quiz next time. Well, before you leave, somebody found out that the answers in the study guide are mostly correct, but they don't correspond to the questions. So the answers to number, like, 23 are, the question number 23, the answers are, like, 47 or something. So so they're mixed up, so you have to pay attention, but it kind of makes sense. Okay? Yeah, ask me some questions. Association fibers.